Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. It's been yet another week of major news coverage of stories that really have not seen straightforward coverage all that often over the last 30, 40 years. The New York Times dropped another big story confirming what we've discussed here more than a few times, namely that the Pentagon really does have a formal UFO study underway. Contrary to some statements they've made over the last several years, it's inside the Office of Naval Intelligence. Congress wants the Department of Defense to establish a formal structure by which the UFO, UAP-related information can be made public. And that's just an astonishing development for those of us who've been following this for a long time, and what looks like a string of astonishing developments over the last 2.5 years on this subject. That Times report provides a good starting point, I think, for where we're going to take you tonight. We're headed for sort of like a freeway interchange, multi-lane, lots of exits and on-ramps and circles and switchbacks, enough to confuse and confound the most diligent of researchers. Like those intrepid investigators in the Pentagon, the pilots who've seen these things up close and personal, and everyone else trying to help figure out what this all means, where they're from, why they're here, who they are. UFOs and UAPs, I think, are just one slice of a much bigger picture. That's where those other lanes come in, other phenomena that don't always seem like they're related at all. You know, dead people popping back into our lives, apparitions, trickster activity, missing time, alien abductions, animal mutilations, crop circles. Are these things even real? Do they fit together somehow? And is it possible, while there may be visitors from other planets somewhere, coming here, that what has been interacting with us is way more complex than mere ETs popping in to collect a couple of plants or watch the crazy humans for a day or two? My oft-mentioned search for the unified theory of weirdness kicks into high gear tonight with two brilliant writers and thinkers who've traveled down some pretty strange roads themselves. Best-selling author Whitley Strieber, whose book Communion landed like a neutron bomb, and whose subsequent work has been an exploration of what these close encounters might mean. What, if anything, the visitors are trying to tell him and us. Whitley returns to the program tonight. He's here for all 4 hours and has new insight that's taken him decades to figure out, new encounters to tell us about, too. Jeffrey Kripal is a rare academic who's embraced spiritual, paranormal, supernatural matters, call them what you will. He's a professor of religious studies at one of the best universities in the country, Rice. He is a profound thinker and a brave author, willing to tread where many of his academic colleagues might not go. And in hindsight, it probably looks like it was inevitable that these two men would meet and collaborate, and they have, on two books that will rock you to your core. One is called The Supernatural: Why the Unexplained is Real. And the other is A New World, written by Whitley with a foreword by Professor Kripal. Turns out they have not only worked together, but have experienced the unknown together in some ways that are both chilling and occasionally almost humorous. We're going to take a deep dive starting in just a few minutes. Jeff Kripal is here for the first half, Whitley for the duration, and we will save some time to take your calls in the last hour. Couple of quick notes, then we'll get right to it. Webmaster Greg Bishop and I have pulled together items and oddities from various media sources. We call it Knapp's News. You can find it on the Coast to Coast AM website. Among the stories there tonight, one piece about Nazi war criminals who faced justice at Nuremberg. Some scientists had a chance to learn about their brains, their psyches, what turned them into monsters. Pretty interesting findings. Also, a synopsis of many far-flung news stories that were generated in the wake of this New York Times coverage of the Pentagon's UFO program. The list is getting longer by the day. Witches hexing the moon on social media. I'm not making that up. Plus, a look at the Reverend Barry Downing, who's been my guest on this program. He's had the decades-long search for common ground between what we call UFOs or UAPs and traditional religion and religious beliefs, something that is definitely on the table for tonight's conversation. That and more in Knapp's News. And while you're on the website, check out how to become a Coast Insider. The cost is pennies a day. If you subscribe for a year, gives you access to a vast archive of programs, including the Art Bell Vault. You can listen anytime you want, as often as you want. And you can learn how to subscribe to George Norrie's television program, Beyond Belief. Great guests, great content, similar to what George does here on the radio. With that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog and the cat and the chicken and the chuckwalla. Put on a pot of Joe. Slide your bod into those silky summer jammies and your toes into those bunny slippers. Plop yourself down in a comfy spot. Turn down the lights and turn up the radio, because we're about ready to rumble. In a moment, Whitley Strieber and Jeffrey Kripal, tying together unexplained phenomena. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Whitley Strieber is the author of many best-selling novels and works of nonfiction. Communion, I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, is one that comes to mind. Four movies have been made from his books, and among his best-known novels are The Wolfen and The Hunger. He has an internet radio program and website, unknowncountry.com, that is the most popular science website in the world. Whitley, great to have you back.
No, it's great to be back. It's not the most popular science website in the world. I wish it was, but it's good. It's very good.
Well, it should be. It's something to strive for. Jeffrey Kripal holds the J. Newton Razor Chair in Philosophy and Religious Thought at Rice University, where he's the chair of the Department of Religious Studies. His present areas of interest, including the comparative erotics of mystical literature, American countercultural translations of Asian religious traditions, and the history of Western esotericism from ancient Gnosticism to the New Age. And wow, that was quite a sentence to read there. Jeff, great to have you here.
Thanks, George.
I'm so glad to have both of you here. You know, so much has been happening on the subjects that the three of us have been pursuing from different angles for a long time, and it feels like the pace has picked up in the last couple of years. And I know so many people out there in the UFO world are demanding, even anticipating something like disclosure, you know, the revelations about secret government programs that have been spilling out in the open, fueling greater expectations. I've tried to sort of lower expectations. Disclosure to me seems unlikely, and I've explained that to people when we have this conversation, for the reason that I'm not so sure anyone really knows what to say. I'm unconvinced that anyone in government or military really knows what's going on, even though they undoubtedly have more information than we do. Whitley, I want to start with the conversation about this, the timely event, this story in the New York Times, and learning more about the government studies and what you make of it, and then are you encouraged?
Well, you know, Jeff and I both know a fair amount about this, and we've got to find out what he thinks. Encouraged is a funny word. It implies that, you know, we're sort of waiting for the big moment when they land, and at last they come stepping out of their flying saucer and give us the secret of gravity or something. And a lot of people are kind of waiting for that level of disclosure. But my thought is that as this emerges, it's going to be a little different from that. Not that there isn't going to be material. There is material. I mean, I have some of it right here in my office. It's the same material that, same from the same hoard of Arts Parts that Linda sold to TTSA, and that is now being studied, I guess, by the Army. We studied it at Southwest Research 20 years ago, and the piece I have, if you look at it under a scanning electron microscope, it's layers of bismuth and magnesium, foamed magnesium in layers, but there's nothing between the layers. There's nothing, there's no adherent holding them together. They're just there. So we got that. Does that mean, oh, it's from another planet? No, it doesn't. It means that we don't know what it is. And back in, years and years ago, Art Exon, General Exon, now deceased, and my Uncle Mickey Edward Streber, also now deceased, were involved in the attempt to reassemble the materials, make the puzzle of the materials that were taken from Roswell to Wright Field in 1947 to make something out of that. And what happened there, I don't know, but I do know those materials existed. And as both Jesse Marcel and my uncle told me personally, they could not fire a bullet through them. It was like a thin tissue that was stronger than anything we then possessed, and maybe so now too. So those materials are real. But, you know, and Jeff, you need to weigh in on this, because there's something more to this than, oh, we're waiting for the flying saucers to land.
Yeah, good luck with that. I mean, good, you know, better not hold your breath waiting for that to happen. I mean, they have landed all over the place, but landing on the White House lawn, walking out to announce themselves, we're going to get into that further. Yeah. Jeff, I guess the same question to you about the New York Times story and the story that preceded it, December 2017, that's, you know, just created waves of media coverage and has captured the interest of a much broader audience than just the regular UFO folks that listen to this show. So many other people who have not really followed UFOs, UAPs closely are now looking at it, paying attention. And from a perspective of somebody who studies religions and religious studies and how they compare, you know, I would think it'd be a really interesting time from an academic standpoint to watch and see how people react. We've seen predictions for a long time when if the real truth comes spilling out, people freak out. And, you know, there's speculation that we're getting dribs and drabs to acclimate us to this. As you've seen these stories unfold the last couple of years, what do you make of it all?
Well, a couple of things, as in about 20 different things. I mean, I think in terms of just the quality of the stories and the level of the information that's being released, the stories that Ralph Blumenthal and Leslie Keene have done in the New York Times are by far the most high profile, kind of high quality stuff we've probably ever seen. And it really has changed the conversation in the public square about the UAP or the UFO phenomenon. There's no question about that. Having said that, I remain skeptical about, not about the phenomena itself, but about this notion of disclosure. And because the whole notion, as both you and Whitley have already explained, presumes that somebody knows, and that, you know, there's somebody somewhere who knows the truth, and now finally they're going to tell us what the truth is. And I actually don't believe that. And in particular, I don't believe that someone in the military or the government even has the capacity or the means of knowing the truth here. I think the military and the sciences are inadequate to really explaining what's going on here. I think they're necessary. I think they have something to offer. I think they do know some things. I don't know what those are because I have no security clearances, but I don't believe for a second that those ways of knowing and those ways of being in the world are going to get us to some deep understanding of this. And I say that not just as somebody who studies religion, which is all about strange beings coming from the sky and doing strange things to human beings. But I also say it as a kind of, as a wannabe anthropologist who has studied a lot of cultural contact and what happens when two different life forms or two different cultures come into contact. And it's often, frankly, not pretty and can be quite dangerous, frankly. To one or both of the cultures. And so I think Whitley's written a lot about this. A lot of people have written a lot about this, all the way back to Charles Fort. And I think that's really where we should be looking, and what we should be talking about is not some grand disclosure, because nobody has such a thing to disclose, but creating some larger conversation where we can start putting all these pieces together to look at how the pixels form, as it were.
Well, I think that's the benefit of something like the New York Times, the stature of that newspaper, reporting it straightforward like a news story, which is how it should be treated by a major newspaper. It gives cover to people in Congress to ask questions. It gives cover for maybe academic colleagues of yours, Jeffrey, to come forward and poke their nose into it and look around. So that is encouraging to me. But, I've had these conversations at UFO events where I say I don't expect disclosure because I don't really believe anybody knows the full story. And then I get hammered by folks who say, but you think they've got crash material, the metamaterials, bits and pieces that have been stashed in grandpa's attic or even technology, as Phil Corso described years ago, or maybe even entire craft. And my answer to that is, it's like throwing a cell phone into a chimpanzee cage, and I think you even get into that, Whitley, in one of these two books about it. It's being a donation place.
Well, that's right. Diana Posilka, in her book, American Cosmic, talks about the donation site, which surprised me because I now that it's public, I always thought it was something that you were to keep under your hat. But, speaking of metamaterials, as I said earlier, I've got some of the metamaterials right here. So they do exist. They certainly exist. And there's others. There's plenty of other stuff. I'm sure there's been extensive work in metallurgy on these materials. Maybe somebody, the way this all works is it's so compartmentalized that you never know as you go along in this whether your discovery was something that was made 25 years ago by someone else. You just don't know that. And so, we're really not able to tell what we know. One of the great challenges, if we're going to really look into this in terms of what is known on an official level, is going to be to figure out what that actually is. Because I'll give you an example of what I mean. When General Exon talked to me after I published Communion, he and my uncle called me to come down to Lackland, the retirement community where he lived, and because he said he wanted to have a conversation with me about some things involved in my book that I would be interested in knowing. And since all I knew about his work in the Air Force was that it had been completely secret all in his entire career, Ann and I jumped on a plane and went roaring down there because we wanted to know what he had to say. And he proceeded to explain a lot to me about what had happened back then. And he introduced me to General Exon by telephone. And General Exon and I had a number of conversations. And one of the things he said was that he was... As late as 1983, I think he said, he was still consulting with the scientific group that was working on this subject of these mysterious materials and other things they may have. And the reason was that they had considered this to be so secret that there was a lot of it was not written down at all. And the result of this is going to be, if we try to look into the documentation of this subject, we're going to have a lot of trouble. Well, another example is the GAO report on the Roswell incident that was produced as a result of a demand by the unfortunately deceased congressman from New Mexico some years ago, about 15 years ago, was that all of the material, written material, right down to paperclip requisitions from the Roswell Army Air Field from 1947 to 1952 had been illegally destroyed. Now, somebody's really working hard there to keep this secret.
Yeah. Just a weather balloon or a double.
They've tried any number of reasons. It's interesting, by the way, isn't it, that the Navy, the all of the disclosure-related material so far that has come out has been from the Navy. The Air Force hasn't peeped about it.
Yeah. Navy. Navy's really leading the way on this, and Air Force has stayed out of it. We're talking with Whitley Strieber and Jeffrey Kripal. Religion is certainly something we're going to touch on multiple times during our conversation tonight with Whitley Strieber and Jeffrey Kripal. You know, when you look at the history of the UFO UAP mystery, one of the explanations given for cover-ups by government, by the military, is the perceived reaction by various faiths around the world. Well, wouldn't religions freak out? And I remember pursuing that when I started down this road and would go to leaders of different faiths here in Las Vegas and other places in the country and just ask them, you know, how do you think your faith would handle big news about another intelligence that we're not the top of the pecking order in the solar system or the universe? And all of them had the same reaction. Like, I don't see any inherent problem with it. They all viewed it as it's a testament to God's greater vision. And it presents the opportunity to save more souls. They were ready to convert ET to whatever their faith was. I guess it boils down to, though, what the truth turns out to be, what the revelation turns out to be, whether or not those religions would really be able to handle it, the news, whatever it is. And in this next segment, we're going to get into some of those possibilities because Jeff and Whitley have explored them in these two books we're going to be covering tonight. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. I don't want to dwell on this forever, but before we leave this question about metamaterials, Whitley had mentioned that he's got a sample, and you guys have written about that there are other samples out there. Jacques Vallée and Gary Nolan have analyzed some. TTSA has some pieces that were intriguing enough for the U.S. Army to cut a deal with them where they're going to do additional analysis. I'm sure there's other governments that have pieces of these things. And even if, as Whitley has discovered, even if it looks like we didn't make this stuff, it doesn't necessarily mean we can figure out who did or where it's from or why we have some of it. Jeff, in the preface to Whitley's new book, A New World, you write about metamaterials and UFOs as vehicles for souls as much as for visitors, right?
I try to stick with what I know, George, and I know the history of religions. I'm not a chemist or a physicist, so I'm always trying to relate what we're talking about to something I can actually say. So yeah, I do that. And so, you know, so has Diana Pasulka at American Cosmic. She's pointed out that a lot of this discussion and a lot of this feel, as it were, feels a lot like what we call relics in the study of religion, which are essentially physical objects that are purported to give some empirical evidence of some contact with a god or a deity. And these do, in fact, feel to me like search for relics.
In the book, The Supernatural, and that's not one word, that's two words, there is a minor disagreement between you and Whitley about the terminology. Supernatural, paranormal. We're never quite sure what term to use for these. What is the difference? Jeff, you can start. What is the difference between which term you're most comfortable with and which ones he accepts and doesn't?
Well, again, I'm a historian, and the supernatural, it's actually three words. The supernatural, that's the title of the book. And we put a space in there because of the argument we were trying to make in that book is that the unexplained is real, but it's also probably entirely natural. We just lack the scientific models of this aspect of nature to understand these things. And so we sort of put them aside as impossible or non-existent, but in fact, they're quite possible and they certainly exist. You know, the supernatural, one word now, was coined somewhere probably around in the 13th century. And it was always used in European Christianity to locate some agency outside the natural order, i.e. in God. So something was supernatural or was miraculous precisely to the extent that its agency issued from outside the material universe. And what's fundamentally changed in our conversation today is that people no longer tend to believe that, and they certainly no longer speak like that. And the word paranormal, which was coined in French in 1903 as paranormal, is exactly this kind of move. It simply meant to the side of the normal, or just after the normal. And it did not mean supernatural. It did not mean outside the natural order. It meant very much inside the natural order, but to the side of our science and our modeling. And so they were thinking of things like poltergeists and telepathy and precognition, you know, really common paranormal phenomena that these scientists were trying to argue were perfectly natural. And so I think Whitley and I share that conviction, but I think Whitley, at least in that book, expressed some concern about the word paranormal, because today it's, you know, it's used, you know, in your big bookstore to talk about romance novels, or it's used on television series to talk about what is essentially demons and ghosts and things that people think are outside the natural order. So I think that's the kind of the, where we're at with the words anyway. I think we're beyond that. I think Whitley and I share the same convictions. We're just really talking about wordsmithing here.
Yeah, I would agree there. I think that there is no paranormal and there is no supernatural. All of these phenomena are part of nature. And in that, I include the whole gamut of ghosts, aliens, all of it. And some of them are probably more part of the physical world than others. But it's just that we don't understand. And the sort of border of human understanding of the way the physical world actually works has been slowly advancing for a long time, and it accelerated dramatically in the 19th century, in particular when things like telegraph and the use of we began to harness things like electricity and then radio. And again and again, the scientific world has very, very slowly moved on, but kind of a little bit behind its own leading edge. Because, for example, in 1905 or 1904, there was a paper published by one of the British scientific academies, a major paper saying that heavier than air travel was not possible, and showing the physics of that. Then the Wright brothers flew a couple of years later, and so science eventually caught up with them. The same thing was true of radio. Prior to the actual appearance of radio, most scientists believed nothing like that was possible. So I have entities in my life that practically live here, that are not visible, that manifest themselves in all kinds of different ways in my life all the time. I don't consider them ghosts. I have no way of identifying them, but I do know this. We don't know what they are yet, but we will eventually. And I could say any number of things about what I think they may be, but I mean, they could be a manifestations of my own psyche. They could be invisible aliens. They could be ghosts. They could be the dead, which is a tremendous part of all of this that we are in the process of discovering, and I certainly did after my wife passed on, that the dead are still here in some way, not necessarily in the simple, straightforward way of well, like Anne said after she died, one of the things that she said after she had, I think, convincingly established the idea that she was still cognizant and aware, she communicated to me, "I'm not Anne anymore, but I'll always be Anne for you." And I understand that now, I think. We're at the edge of a huge change. An enormous breakthrough is in the process of happening, and it nuts and bolts level of seeing UAPs on video from the Navy to the most esoteric possibilities that may be in the process of unfolding about things like parallel universes and the continued existence of the dead. It's all a spectrum of new realities that we are going to reach. The truth is that the human mind is in the process of outgrowing its own concept of reality. And people like me and Jeff and you, too, for that matter, George, and a lot of your listeners are just in the process of pushing against the border because we've come up to the border. It's time to go beyond it.
I have these conversations both in my private life and then interacting with the public and sometimes in interviews where I try to explain it like it's like a big wheel and there's different spokes on this wheel and the UAP spoke. If you stay on that thing long enough and get down to the hub, you find that there's a connection between these other topics and there it's not a comfortable thing. Same thing with ghosts and cryptids. Somebody might be a Bigfoot hunter and he's pursuing an undiscovered species of ape out there in the forest. And then he starts seeing reports or maybe sees it himself of Bigfoot getting out of a UFO or in proximity of a UFO or a ghost hunter who is checking out a haunted house and suddenly there's aliens popping in and out. They're uncomfortable with it. But if they stick with it long enough, they find that there is, in fact, some sort of commonality between these subjects. It's figuring out that commonality that seems to be the challenge. And as you said, it's a new understanding of reality. It's up to us to figure it out.
And, you know, so, George, and the temptation there is to then jump to the conclusion, oh, well, then it's religion. You know, the believer or the religious leader has all the answers now. And, of course, that's not true either. But these connections are definitely there. I was thinking of Diana Pasulka when you were talking. You know, Diana's a colleague of mine in the study of religion, and she was actually working on the history of purgatory. And the history of purgatory in Europe is filled with all of these artifacts or relics of essentially dead souls interacting with human beings and the physical artifacts that are left behind. You know, there might be a burned cloth or someone might see a ball of light, and these were all interpreted as souls in purgatory needing prayer. So that's sort of the religious uptake of it. But this is what got her eventually into the UFO phenomena. So she sort of went the other direction. So I agree completely with you. These things are all connected underneath. And I think the temptation we have to resist is that, oh, now with modern science, we have the answers. But we also have to resist the temptation, oh, the religious people have all the answers. No. Nobody has all the answers here. But the more we know about history, I think, the better off we're going to be. And if I could just add just two little details here that I think will help. Whenever someone says the word ghost today, what we really think of is some kind of spooky, wispy, cloudy figure that you can kind of see through but looks somehow human. But what we don't realize is that historically speaking, a lot of apparitions of the dead are actually physical. The people seeing them insist that they're fully physical, that they do things like eat or walk through doors or touch people or breathe on people. You know, so historically, human beings have always argued that these encounters with the dead can be completely physical, just as well as they can be more apparitional and wispy, the kind of classical ghost thing. And the other thing to keep in mind is, you know, in the ancient world, when people spoke of the spiritual, they didn't mean the non-physical. The spiritual was a kind of physical substance. It was just really, really subtle. So they didn't have this kind of dualism, I think, that people work with today, that there's something's either physical and material and we can measure it with science, or it's completely mental and spiritual and it's essentially non-existent. That just didn't exist, that dichotomy. I think that's something we're still struggling with today, is that dualism, as it were.
Whitley, I've gone through, we have a website where I post all my stories from over the last 30 or so years. And one of the first books I read as I was trying to cram all this stuff into my head was Communion. And one of the first interviews I did for the very first series that I produced about the UFO mystery was with you. It was a satellite interview in 1989 with you, and which has always stuck with me, some of the things that you had told me then and things that I read in Communion. One of them being that with all the secrecy involved and our, you know, how difficult it is to get our heads around this, that the visitors are the ones who are the true architects of that. You know, the military, the governments around the world know more than we do and throw up roadblocks to us understanding it, the public, I mean, but it's the visitors that really are central to us not understanding it. But it feels like from these two new books that's changing.
Well, I think that the visitors are exquisitely in control of all of this. Anything to do with them, they're on top of it. And I don't think that there's some place somewhere in some secret room where they're telling people what to do. I think that they do this clandestinely because I think that they have remarkable skills of social engineering, and they also have the ability to influence people's minds. And I don't think that I'm talking about aliens either. I think I'm talking about something human, but that the human species is not necessarily bound either to this planet or, as Jeff was suggesting a moment ago, to this level of reality. Now, so what's happening now to me is that at some level of consciousness, wherever they, quote unquote, are, there is a loosening of the bondage. Now, as far as I know, incidentally, the United States is far ahead of any other country in terms of its knowledge of this, and I can tell you precisely why. It's because the United States is so free, and there are reasons why this other level of reality wants the richest possible variety of relationship with us, and it finds that very easily here, because if you go down a street in the United States, and you're going to meet people from every kind of culture in the world, and most of them are going to be living together reasonably peacefully most of the time. And that's absolutely unique.
I tell you what, we're going to have to take a break here because this is sort of a central thesis of your book, A New World, the relationship between us and them. And I want to have plenty of time for you to explain that. We're going to take a break. When we come back, going to get into some specific experiences that both of these men have had in their pursuit of trying to understand the bigger mystery.